Welcome to this episode of The World According to Irina Sukerman, our very special series on global politics on the KJ Masterclass Live. Irina Sukerman is an US-based national security and human rights lawyer, as well as a renowned geopolitical analyst. Her writings and commentary have appeared in diverse US and international media and have been translated to over a dozen languages. Every fortnight in The World According to Irina Sukerman, we traverse the geopolitical landscape and delve into pressing international issues and gain insight from Irina's expert perspective. Welcome to the show once again, Irina.
Thank you so much, and I'm very glad to be here as usual.
You are welcome. Welcome to the show. Welcome. Several big topics today, lots on India today. But first, the very important news that's making, you know, the world news is the Baltimore Bridge. We'll talk about the Russian concert attack and the Netanyahu-Biden relationship. So first, how do you see this Baltimore Bridge? Several voices coming in. Initially, people said there might be some foul play, but it does not look like. What is your understanding for our audience so that they can understand this better?
Unfortunately, it seems quite banal. I mean, or fortunately. Fortunately, it's not a terrorist attack or a cyber attack of any sort. Unfortunately, the issues that were involved are becoming more and more common. The power going out among the ships, issues with electronics, poor maintenance and upkeeps that led to the ship to crash into the bridge to begin with. They are unfortunately becoming more common, which means we could see more similar incidents in the future if the upkeep of these systems is not reviewed following this incident. And from the looks of it, there was also conflagration of unfortunate events. The very size of that ship made it inevitable that the bridge would crash as a result, simply because it was a container ship that was very, very huge in size. And so it was just a physical issue. No terrorists, ships in other bridges in other locations are likely to be safe, but you know, it is a very unfortunate incident and costly on top of the, you know, more criminal issues that we are dealing with on a daily basis, attacks on water utilities and so forth. So having these self-made avoidable disasters is not great news. And unfortunately, the information of the fact that these electronic issues are common enough is also bad news in terms of our security, generally speaking, because adversarial forces watching such incidents do learn from the kind of lack of competence when dealing with them about our vulnerabilities.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Irina. It is the good part is that not much loss has happened in terms of life. Few people are missing. I'm sure they will be found soon. But one thing I just want, you know, try to understand is that if people lose control of their ship like this, if it was a news, say, in some other part of the world, it could be understood. But whenever people talk about logistics efficiency, they always talk about the US. And, you know, and so this sort of a thing happening, how should we understand this? This is the future that we are going to see in terms of, you know, things can suddenly go wrong. Is this too much of dependence on electronics? Earlier, we never heard of an incident like this.
Well, freak accidents do unfortunately happen in every industry. So on the one hand, it's not necessarily, you know, an issue that will rise again anytime soon in that particular chain of events. Unfortunately, the fact that there is a quality control issues and people simply not dealing with physical elements of infrastructure well, a lot of it has gotten oversourced to other countries, specifically to China, over the past decades. And I think we are at an early stage of kind of trying to bring this physical quality issues back to the US. I've been hearing a lot about exciting new startups looking to kind of replace these outdated of hardware and infrastructural issues with domestic products that are focused on higher quality and that are, will have higher quality control issue in the US. I think it will take time to get back to the point. And they, we may be for some, you know, we'll have to deal with having to replace these things sooner rather than later. In the meantime, until we get more durable infrastructure back. But unfortunately, you know, for those who've been buying any sort of electronics, fridges, microwaves, TV sets, we see that they're compared to what someone would have gotten, you know, 30, 40 years ago, less durable in general. And unfortunately, these electronics on the ships are no exception. It's just a perfect illustration of recent discussions I have had about why it's so important to keep this sort of key industries in the U.S. and have quality products that are based in the U.S. and cannot be either due to poor maintenance, due to poor quality, or due to deliberate sabotage, create similar situations in the future.
Right, right, Arina. Now let's go to Russia, Russian concert attack. What do we make out of this? Some days back, they said that they foiled one attack on a synagogue, and then others also warned of something like this, and then this happens, and then some of these people, they have been caught with all those figure, you know, pictures coming on television. What do we make out of this? Is it that Russian security agencies have been very quick to arrest those people, the attackers, or is it that a lack of coordination among them, and this has led to all these things happening and so many people looking at life? How do some people suspect, you know, that it may be a different thing altogether? I don't know how to put it, but what is your understanding of this?
Well, there's certainly a lot of mysterious parts to this whole story, and perhaps we will never know everything that happens, because Russia certainly has not been transparent about sharing its own investigations with the public. But what we do know is that a few days prior to this attack, Putin has publicly dismissed the intelligence warnings from the US and other countries, claiming them to be provocations. We also know that previously, a year or two ago, there has been an imitation, a training exercise involving a fake rescue attempt at that specific exact location. So if there was this training exercise, it begs the question, why were the security services so slow to react? There is apparently a police station across the street from that particular theater, and it took the police an hour to arrive when it was already too late. No one can understand how all four shooters were able to escape completely. Now, we have to admit that it's very interesting that ISIS-K, which is an Afghanistan and Central Asian affiliate of ISIS, they share ideology and so forth, and they are quite extreme, and they don't particularly care for Russia or for anybody else for that matter. They've released right away the footage from their body cameras by the shooters, as well as their photos. And the group of Tajik nationals who were apparently arrested by Russia, there's a lot of questions where they are really tied into the attack, or whether they're just random guest workers who were rounded up to show that the security services are doing something. And there's no real way to figure that out. There's a lot of these foreign laborers in Russia from Central Asia. It's kind of like Mexican and Latin American fruit pickers and laborers in parts of the United States. Some of them don't really have great command of Russian. Some of them are, you know, construction workers or whatever, sellers of random stuff in open markets, and they're not particularly, you know, some of them drink or, you know, smoke something. So, you know, these guys that we rounded up, it's not clear whether you know, David described as a gang that really couldn't shoot straight, but ISIS-K is actually some of the more competent ISIS affiliates. These are not lone wolf individuals radicalized online or in their mosque. They're fairly trained groups of terrorists that have a coherent, you know, cellular structure. So I have trouble believing that they were so completely unprepared for mass attack that they made all the mistakes that we have seen, which included throngs of people fleeing from the scene even as the attack was occurring. The exits were unguarded. During this entire time, no, you know, any typical mass shooting in a closed environment usually includes four shooters guarding all the exits. That's why you have a whole group of them, generally speaking, precisely to avoid people being able to flee. So there's certainly a lot of questions, and Russia certainly quickly used the opportunity for propaganda purpose to push the Ukraine angle, to claim that some of these ISIS people originally came from Ukraine. And you know, it's very self-serving, but Russia has also been trying to mobilize formally people at this moment. So this attack certainly comes at a timely manner. At various points in time, they also claim that US, UK, and Israel were involved, which really makes no sense whatsoever. All of that does not, you know, reflect well on Russian intelligence services. It makes them at best look incompetent for having missed many red flags about a well-known threat actor operating in their area and for being very slow to respond to an ongoing attack. Or at worst, it fuels conspiracy theories, which you have mentioned previously, the record of allowing operations to for political reasons, or even being actively facilitating them. There were some elements of them in the past. So all of that is not particularly good look for Russia, no matter how you interpret it. What's interesting is there were poorly translated videos of some of these individuals who allegedly came through Turkey and supposedly were paid sums of money to participate in the attack without any clear details. What we do know is right after all of this happened, Turkey rounded up 147 individuals claiming they were affiliated with ISIS. So on the one hand, Turkey does really have an ISIS problem, and this is no secret. And Turkey invited some of these people in, and there's places called basis ISIS hotels in Istanbul and other areas. On the other hand, Turkey has also been known to use terrorist incidents to round up opposition of various types, including in particular Kurds. So it's not clear whether what Turkey is doing is a legitimate, you know, but very much belated response, and whether the passage of whoever actually did attack through Turkey was facilitated by any sorts of local ISIS organization, or whether it's just a cover. But a lot going on, and none of it is looking particularly good, no matter how you slice it.
Right, Irina. Whatever the facts of the case, that we will know or we don't, we'll never know. We don't know at the moment. But one thing I want to understand is the messaging. ISIS-K going out and trying to take responsibility that, listen, it is we have done it. This is what I understand. Correct me at any place where I'm incorrect. Second is Russia, immediately, you know, talking about Ukraine, also talking about that, listen, these attackers were going towards Ukraine, so there must be some element of, you know, Ukraine's involvement. What is it that, you know, as I said, the facts we don't know, but what is it that different players here are trying to prove or achieve, whatever the facts?
Well, if you are ISIS-K, of course, you're going to want to take credit for a major attack, because that's how you recruit followers. That's how you message your success. This is kind of like someone, an event organizer, pulling off a successful event. Even if there were 100 different organizations involved, you will still try to take at least some credit. But we also saw that there's something interesting going on. ISIS-K recently claimed credit for an attack that took place in Iran, which precipitated all sorts of events. But what did not happen is Iran attacked anybody and everybody except for ISIS-K positions, whether in Afghanistan or in Tajikistan, did not actually go after them. And at that time, US too very quickly pointed out, claimed, agreed with the group's own messaging that it was indeed ISIS-K who did the job. So I think what we need to do is step back for a second and look at what ISIS-K is, what ISIS is, what all these terrorist organizations are, and they largely share very similar ideology. There may be tweaks here and there, and certainly power struggles over who is the leader and who is the best, of these groups and who is the most genuine of the genuine terrorists. But what we do know is that all these groups share same vision. They're fluid. Their members sometimes go from one group to another, from ISIS-K to ISIS, they travel. And sometimes, aside from actually being part of this formal relation, they take on mercenary jobs to make extra money or to make extra claim. So you could claim that your ISIS affiliates took on an attack, even if they were actually being paid and the attack was organized by somebody else. It could still be technically true that ISIS-K was, that the signature steps or the members who involved belonged to ISIS and shared ISIS ideology and proclaimed that they were ISIS. So ISIS-K may very well be taking credit for attacks that involved some of its support or some of its members, but they did not themselves organize, or somebody else organized and for their own agenda.
Right. And about for Putin, after you see these attacks and immediately after the victory in elections, if you were Putin, would you consider yourself stronger or weaker with all these incidents in the backdrop of your victory?
Well, it depends, of course, on whether or not he was the one who ordered the attack or allowed it to happen. But I have to say, no matter what his level of involvement or goals were, it is not a good look, because his message is not coherent. He first claimed that it was Ukrainians, then he was forced to admit that ISIS-K and radical Islamists took some part. And then there's questions. Why are there radical Islamists operating in the middle of Moscow when Russia claimed that they're defenders of Christendom, that they're fighters of ISIS, and so on and so forth? Why have they allowed such a flow of movement? And even if you decide that all of this is due to incompetence and due to the fact that Russia is distracted with Ukraine, this means they're not able to manage their own internal resources correctly, allowing terrorist organizations to get inside, gather intelligence, and operate under the noses of all these fearsome FSB officers and carry on what they did. And then, in order to get information, you have to literally torture people in public and make them eat their own ears. Like, they're, I think they watched too much Mike Tyson, because, if you're torturing someone to that extent, how do you even know they're going to give you accurate information? And maybe that wasn't the goal. Maybe the goal was just to scare outsiders and say, this is what we do, regardless of whether or not these are the people who did it.
Right. Now, looking at the Russia-Ukraine war, how do you see it going forward with, with this thing in the backdrop? If it is true, not true, we don't know, we will never know. And with the recent Russian attacks on Ukraine with missiles and all, where does this end in the backdrop of this Russian Ukraine aid, getting aid or not aid? How do you look at this whole thing going forward? Is Ukraine losing ground, or will the aid come in timely for it to fall? Because the war has to get over today or tomorrow. If it gets too long, it will not be a good thing for the world.
Well, on the one hand, what's positive for Ukraine is that Czechia and a group of other European countries managed to scramble together enough ammunition that is being transferred over to tide Ukraine over and to prevent complete disaster. And they were really being put in a very, very difficult situation and had to really cut down any offensive operations and cede, you know, some ground. And they were also under attack from the air, and it was becoming quite complicated. So that is a major, major positive development. I think it will take some time for all this ammunition to come through. So we will probably have to see some weeks or a couple of months before the impact of this new ammunition comes in, but that's something positive. On the other hand, while all of this is going on, Ukraine has been successful attacking oil refineries in Russia, which are shut down. They cannot be quickly restarted, and they are costing Russia money, and Russia is also losing money on other fronts because of sanctions. That's not to say that they're not that they're completely helpless. They're managing to adjust to all of this by working with North Korea, China, and so forth, getting some supplies, getting equipment, dealing with third countries that are through which they're able to smuggle the equipment and parts they need to restart some of their production. So they also have a strategic victory that no one is acknowledging in terms of shutting down any sort of trade in the Black Sea and essentially terrorizing the international maritime forces from really traveling. They're sort of at Turkey's mercy, but Turkey chose not to clamp down on them as much as they really could, and they are doing enough business with Turkey to explain why that is happening. So strategically, you know, they've placed Ukraine in a bad position. Ukraine is achieving tactical, scoring tactical points by attacking successfully Russian ships. But, you know, I think with time, Russia could overcome even that problem because they're now talking about a return to the Black Sea, which means that these tactical hits are simply not enough for a longer-term game. A lot will, of course, depend on the rest of U.S. aid. Congress won't be back in session until April 9th, and, you know, one of the members of Congress filed a petition to remove Speaker Johnson over unrelated budgetary concerns. The House Democrats promised to save his position if he follows through with giving some aid to Ukraine. The problem is, while he agreed to that position, he is still not doing the simplest thing to get this whole thing resolved, which is simply bringing the existing version of the Senate humanitarian bill to the floor. Instead, there's been several different proposals, while there's also two discharge petitions ongoing. Republican advantage in House is being erased as a number of people retired early, and you know, that makes it easier for the Democrat discharge petition, which would force that bill to be voted on, but still not enough to get there. And the Republicans started their own petition, and so they're not likely to join the Democrat one over partisan consideration. So we are still kind of stuck, and, you know, the best case scenario is maybe May or June before anything happens, and we don't even know. I think Speaker Johnson's strategy is just to procrastinate as long as possible and to waste time and not get anything resolved out of concern for his supporters, who are adamant against this aid coming through in any version. And of course, there's also talk of separate bills, breaking the bill down into separate components, but the Senate will not likely to agree to that, even if any or all of those bills pass in the House. So we are kind of at an impasse, and it's seriously enabling Russia, not only from the point of view of combat advantage, but also from a strategic and psychological perspective, because this sort of polarization over national security issues and basic foreign policy is essentially giving them more room to exploit the political situation in the US, much less in Ukraine.
Right, right. One thing I want to understand, Irina, is that whatever the aid or not aid, the fact is that the solution has to come, you know, from talks. And it is almost like a stalemate. So even if it is today, tomorrow, or 3 years down the line, it has to be talks. Also, if they think that, you know, more and more countries will come together and Russia will have to look at it, the Russians have already said, Putin has already said, talked about nuclear use of nuclear weapons. And I read recently was that the nuclear threshold for Russia is much lower than they what officially say. And there was this. So it was like they would have less tolerance in terms of if they they bear certain degree of losses. How does all these things pan out? Because then this is a very difficult situation. It can't be a 10-year war. Nobody will be able to do that. And it is it looks like to be a stalemate. How do you see this thing? When do you see a solution will come, whether aid or no aid, with whatever Ukraine is also, you know, digging its heels in?
I actually don't think that Russia is very likely to use those tactical nuclear weapons. And they had many opportunities to do that, which would have been strategically far more advantageous to use at that point in time than they are now. I do think that they're trying to, they feel that the more time they waste, the better it is for them politically, and they're correct. Because we still see significant disagreements within NATO. We're seeing political changes in some countries. Poland has allowed Russian destroyers to launch missiles through its space, and then the Russian ambassador simply ignored the demand to be called up to, you know, for an official reprimand. So they feel like they've gained some ground, and they feel like they could gain more ground, and they won't have to deal with any sort of drastic suicidal apocalyptic moves if they can get what they want through, you know, political strategy. And I think this is exactly what they're going for. There's elections in France, and while Macron has been talking tough and about possibly sending French troops to Ukraine to complement the very troops who are not enlisting in combat voluntarily, and there's a big controversy over mobilization, Marine Le Pen is rising in the polls, and this has happened in the past, and in the end she lost, but we don't know the outcome this time around, because the last time there wasn't a war and Russia was not spending quite as heavily on lobbying efforts. And we're seeing increased demonstrations of all these farmers. Now the farmer protests reached the United Kingdom. So all of that means that Russia is really capitalizing politically on discontent, on mismanagement, on local issues and controversies. And the more it can capitalize, the less it has to actually do militarily. It doesn't need to be all that successful to make the international community abandon this whole project in terms of short-term gain. And we've seen some of the industry kind of returned to Russia already, and some sanctions are being lifted. So this is success from Russia's standpoint. They don't need to engage in nuclear warfare. They used that threat enough to generate panic, which was exactly their calculus successfully. And now they're exploiting the snowballing divisions in various Western countries very successfully.
Right, right. Now from one war to move on to another war, that's the Middle East. What is happening there? Is it with this love affair gone suddenly, Ori? What will happen now? Biden and Netanyahu, is it indication that Netanyahu's time at the helm of affairs is over? How do you look at this recent development, and where are we going on the war between Israel and Hamas?
Israel is indeed facing internal leadership challenges, but less so over this alleged dispute with the US, and more so, ironically, over completely domestic internal matters regarding the so-called Haredi recruitment bill, with some members of the government threatening to leave the coalition and, you know, potential destabilization of the coalition over that domestic political issue. Frankly, if the Biden administration really wanted to pressure Israel, they could be doing a lot more than political posturing at the UN over non-binding resolutions that have no real impact. They could be sanctioning, they could be denying aid. Instead, they signed into the, you know, a huge standard aid package into the budget that, just passed. So, and there's a lot of rhetoric and pressure on Israel, but at the end of the day, Hamas is vetoing any reasonable compromises or solutions, and there's nothing the administration can do. You know, if a terrorist organization is absolutely refusing to do basic things for even a ceasefire, there's no way they can force Israel to stop defending itself. The biggest controversy is over the Rafah operation, which Netanyahu admittedly has not announced any time frame or plan for, and that is the most concerning part, whether he is actually has a plan on how to do it. The US did put clear conditions on allowing on humanitarian evacuations and the building of the humanitarian pier, and Israel announced that this was that they would agree to that. What is actually going to happen isn't clear, I think, to everyone involved, because I don't think anybody, not Netanyahu, not Biden, not any of the other stakeholders, are actually sure what's going to happen next. I think a lot of this is hot air. I don't think there's an actual clear plan or vision. I think everybody is kind of stuck because the publicity over this has been blown up in a way that is politically damaging to everybody, but there's no going back and there's no move forward. And there's also this little dance everyone is doing because of the elections in the United States. So I really don't see how that's going to play out. I think they're playing it by, everyone is playing it by ear in a very reactionary way. What I do have to say, though, is that, you know, the Biden administration has been pivoting its rhetoric to the more progressive and pro-Hamas lobbies in the US and international pressure to avoid being seen as weak and too pro-Israel and unfair to the Palestinians and so forth. In reality, it's actually making itself look weak when Hamas goes out and celebrates its these resolutions and the US position on them. You don't want a terrorist organization that you have openly committed to fighting celebrating anything you do. That's a sign of a failed policy right there. So you know, if you come to a point that you have to that you're trying to appease terrorists who are refusing to give in to go along in any way, you are doing something wrong. So whatever Biden's motivation, needs to reevaluate it, not because of Israel, but because the message it sends about the US and its ability to keep to its own commitments and face its own enemies. And Hamas has repeatedly engaged in anti-American rhetoric. Before this war, before anything with Israel, they've been consistently anti-American, and they've been consistently with Iran. And this is not something that the U.S. should be allowing. They should not be enabling their own enemies, regardless of any other controversies involved.
Right, right, Irina. Now, let's look at this all two, three factors here. Is this resolution enforceable in any way? No. How does it look like? It cannot be. Or it can be. So Biden gets what? Rhetoric, he got some brownie points. Hamas, what does it get? And Israel, is it time? What happens to Netanyahu? Again, he continues to be there, or will there be a change of leadership? Also, when they talk about the hostages, do you think after 6 months of this whole war, the fate of the hostages is not very well known? How do you see all these players? Is it like only optics for the world and actually nothing happening at the ground? And in Gaza, it is we are staring at the at the impending famine.
I'm not sure about the famine. I think the famine is to some extent artificial in the sense that the food is actually there. Hamas is confiscating it and reselling it at higher prices. So I'm sure the humanitarian situation is deteriorating. I'm not at all sure that it is the mass starvation that is being reported by pro-Hamas sources. I have not seen any evidence of that. And, you know, when there's a horrible massive famine, you have evidence of people actually starving. I hate to say it, but in Yemen during the civil war, in Sudan during the war that's ongoing now, you have horrifying pictures of, you know, people looking like they're starving. You're not seeing that from Gaza. Yes, a lot of people have been killed, but do we actually know how many of them are civilians and how many of them are fighters and how many of them, you know, civilians who have in fact participated in some aspects of fighting? So they're, you know, not necessarily full-time Hamas employees, but they may be sympathizers who are performing various tasks in that capacity. There's absolutely no way to get the data at that moment, and I think it's a fool's errand to even try, so long as Hamas controls any institutions there. The fact that that Hamas still has control of the so-called Gaza Health Ministry after 6 months is to me absolutely incredible, as is the fact that some of these terrorists continue to return to Al-Shifa hospital after being cleared out of there, and there's hundreds if not thousands of these people being arrested, killed, and so forth. And the question is, how effective are these operations if these guys keep coming back? So I don't see a clear plan. I see a lot of talking. I see a lot of concern about, you know, bad publicity. And I also see a lot of hypocrisy, because the same Middle Eastern Arab countries who are crying wolf me over the humanitarian disaster are, first of all, not sending as much aid as they claim to, are not volunteering to distribute it directly in many cases. And furthermore, they are now refusing to fund UNRWA after all these claims about how they should give billions to it to make up for US and other countries' aid being lost. So we are seeing a few small European countries in Australia and Canada return to funding UNRWA, but then the Arab states that seem to have the most and who cried about it the loudest are not doing that. So what does that tell you about the credibility of that organization? I think actions speak a lot louder than words, and for all the loud rhetoric and condemnations and saying how it's the worst disaster in the world, people are not acting like it's the worst disaster in the world.
Right. And one strange thing I noticed was that earlier there were a lot of people's voices in earlier conflict. Nowadays, almost everyone seems to be quiet, or maybe I'm not reading the right places, you know, because I don't see those words there. In terms of Israel, you see Netanyahu has to go for elections. There the thing is still, we have to see if I'm understanding it right. Even Zelensky, he has to also look at, get re-elected. That thing is also pending. In Russia, the elections, so-called elections, have already, people have questioned the way it has happened. It has been happening in Russia. In the US, again, the elections are deciding everything. People's voices is, you know, somewhat, either they have kept quiet, people have their own different views, but somehow it is just the government's talking in all these conflict zones, or only the interested party. Why has people suddenly vanished from all these conflicts? Or is it a very sanitized version that these people are trying to portray to the world? How do you look at it purely from a people's point of view?
Well, I have to say that in some cases, with respect to Israel-Gaza war, there was absolutely deliberate mobilization of mob kind of outcries at various, especially in Arab countries, before elections and other events there, which have quieted down. And there's been a crackdown on these demonstrations. And some of these demonstrations were organized not by any sort of grassroots mobilization, but by very specific interest groups. So now that the need for that has gone away, so have these outrage mobs. On the contrary, in Europe and the United States, a lot of this activity continues, but you can see that a lot of these people are, you know, astroturfers. They migrate from one place to another, so there's not necessarily more of them. It's probably the same people who are the most active. You have a lot of anti-Israel activity on campus that's not really stopping, but you also do have more government and university reaction and investigation. And I think at the end of the day, once the government starts to get involved, there's more incentive for the universities to try to regulate things a little bit better. But in Ukraine, the elections are probably not going to happen until the end of the war, whatever that may look like. And there is a very strong internal sentiment by most people there concerning that. That is actually how most people think, whether or not they ultimately agree with every aspect of the government strategy. Otherwise, they just don't. Nobody thinks it's a good time for elections right now. In Israel, it's different. There's a lot of dissatisfaction with Netanyahu and with the government, but there's also a sort of reluctance to kind of, you know, to be honest with you, I think there would be much more push for new elections if anyone had a very clear strategy, but then I don't think anyone does. Not Netanyahu and not any of the people who are competing against them. And I think they all kind of are faced with the same problem, managing the security situation and, on the other hand, appealing to these U.S. election sentiments. And in the U.S., most people are completely apolitical. They don't know anything about Gaza or Ukraine or Russia. They only echo what is being fed to them by the voices they trust and the people around them. So if we are hearing a lot of talking points about this and that, it's not because anyone has taken the time to really delve into the conflict and assess their position in the matter. It's because everybody around them or their favorite politicians or their favorite media celebrity is making comments about it. So in the US, I think the situation is a little different than in other parts of the world. I don't think a lot of these positions on anything, with the exception of some particular groups who are directly affected by this, I think most people are just repeating what sounds good based on, you know, domestic political considerations and not any sort of real investment into any of these political situations abroad.
Right, right. From that part of the world to my part of the world, that is India and all. So how do you see, suddenly India has, you know, come up, though India has been making a lot of name for itself globally, but in terms of the maritime security, India has got very active in terms of fighting Somali pirates, rescuing international ships. And amidst all these things, China sends fourth spy ship into the Indian Ocean. How do you see India's growing role? How do you see China's steps like this? You know, and I saw some pictures of the Somali pirates, some of this, you know, being brought to India. Some of them were smiling, in fact, laughing. I'm trying to understand why were they doing so in captivity, a situation like this. Help us understand all this for us, Irina.
Well, I have to say, if there's anyone complaining, you know, the rumors of India's alleged brutality are obviously greatly exaggerated, you know, because normally people, you know, in captivity, even if it's by the US or whoever, they don't normally tend to smile. At the very least, they'll be disappointed that they failed at whatever they do. It seems to me that maybe the Somali pirates are looking to escape their own situation at home and try to use it to hitch a free ride somewhere where they don't face the same sort of a turmoil as in Somalia. I do find it amazing that the Somali pirates have ventured so far away from their own shores. They used to wait for ships to come by near the Horn of Africa and attack them in the vicinity. Now they're venturing all the way into the Indian Ocean, which is quite far, and trying to attack very well equipped ships. It's amazing. I think, you know, it's either desperation or something else. I'm sure some of them are opportunistically trying to use the chaos from the Houthi attacks, or even some of them may even be coordinating with them. But in the case of that particular group of people, maybe they wanted to get caught and ask for political asylum. Yeah, maybe that was their way of their own self-rescuing themselves. But more seriously, India, I think without intending to, quite honestly, is being pushed into becoming a major naval power. And it's really once you start participating in sort of in these sort of operations, even if this is a case of greatness being thrust upon you without any planning on your part, you will automatically be taken more seriously on the international stage. I don't think this was India's plan to get quite so entangled in that particular area so quickly. I think India was happy to participate in Quad exercises and other types of exercises and to build up its military against China and so forth. I think, however, their primary focus was more on the economic endeavors and certainly not on these fights. The situation happened. I don't think anyone predicted that it would go as far as India's shores, nor did anyone really predict that China would get as aggressive as far away from its own sphere, direct sphere of influence, as it did. And I think, India's response is really out of necessity for its own security, for regional security, and it's all hands on deck, so to speak, no pun intended, because we are seeing that there is a U.S.-led sort of group of defensive interests in the Red Sea. You have a European alternative, but all of them are not coordinating directly with each other, and they're not quite enough. So India is kind of is the third way here, but they're also really, really, turning out to be quite active. And I think if China was hoping that India would take a much more restrained and passive approach, I think they completely miscalculated.
Right. And what about China? How should we look at China? What is China trying to achieve here in the Indian Ocean with sending its spy ship?
Quite frankly, I think they're investigating underwater cables. We have already seen what happens when a sinking ship damages internet cables, and parts of Africa ended up being affected. It is not a good thing, and those things are very difficult to fix. So I think China's interest is definitely in exploring at least, those strategic communication possibilities. I think it would be a huge victory for China if something like that happened to India. It would be very damaging and would take months to fix, and it would be a major victory without having to actually fire guns and engage in any direct confrontations. And certainly they want to send a message that they are confident enough to venture as far out as they are to a very strong big country. This is not a small Taiwan or Singapore or something like that we're talking about. So they're sure sending a very strong message that they are able to challenge their adversaries and rivals on multiple fronts in multiple locations in coordination with other countries, but also pursuing their own independent agendas. And this the idea that they're being as forward as they are should give us pause about why they feel as free to do so as they do. Why is it that China, that does not belong anywhere close to Indian shores, feels like they can do all that and also be fighting with Philippines and fighting with Taiwan and sending balloons to the US and so forth? This is not, there's a clear failure of international deterrence on everyone's part here.
Right, Irina. So this year, almost half the humanity is going through elections or has gone through some of these places. India too, the biggest country, the largest country in the world in terms of population, it is going to have its elections, general elections, federal elections in the next couple of months. Next month it starts. and the results come out in June. Amidst this backdrop, there is one opposition leader, Arvind Kejriwal. He has been, you know, he's the chief minister of Delhi. He has been arrested on graft charges. How do you look at this development from that part of the world, Irina?
I mean, this his arrest raised a lot of controversy in the West because, you know, a lot of the sources reporting on this are questioning the timing of the arrest. They're claiming, well, you know, how convenient that he was caught on some, you know, private business related graft now in the middle of the elections. And, you know, isn't it convenient that this is the one of the opposition leaders who is doing all this thing and not some lesser known figure and so on and so forth. So basically they're saying that he is being politically sidelined and that he had a real chance to make a difference. I actually disagree, regardless of how the investigation was handled, whether there was enough evidence to arrest him earlier or not, or whether or not the timing is convenient. I really don't think he's a serious challenge, actually. I think based on the data coming out of India, the economy is booming. Yes, there are always some sort of issues in a huge country. It would be shocking if they weren't. And actually, I think it's quite positive that these issues are being discussed openly rather than suppressed. This is not North Korea, where you have really no idea what's going on and when everybody's, you know, just praising the dear leader all the time. But you know, all things considered, I think the ruling party has gained a lot of backing due to success of its policies, and it's very hard to argue with it. So I don't think that it needs to be fearful of serious challenges. And I think there is enough, you know, people speaking out on a regular basis, and most of them, or overwhelming majority of them, except for this one guy, are not getting arrested for anything. So I think this is kind of a stretch, in my opinion.
Right, Irina, we'll keep on getting your perspective on the Indian elections. But your perspective on Reliance, you know, industries backing away from Russian oil after US sanctions. How do you see that? Is it about the logistics, or is it about the oil? How do you see this from that part of the world?
Honestly, it's a couple of things. On the one hand, it's, you know, sanctions are being imposed, so it's a cost. There's basic self-interest at play here from a big, successful private business. And it's a reputational risk. You don't want to tie up in something that's not, you know, doesn't smell right. But on the other hand, there is also the fact that Russian oil has also been becoming more expensive. At one point, it really made sense for India to fill it up its reserves with the cheapest thing possible, but this is no longer the case. It's actually not as cheap as it used to be for a variety of economic reasons, and there are other sources available. And interestingly enough, India is not actually buying from the very, very cheapest sources. It's actually buying more from the United States, and I think there is a strategic calculation there, as well as there are all sorts of other factors involved. But it is no longer just simple economic consideration. And I also think that as India becomes more economically developed, it will have care about other factors other than the very basic cost. It will also care about the quality of oil, where it's coming from, how it can be used strategically, and what it can get in return from buying the product from a close ally. And I think there may be other things of interest tied into where it's getting its oil from.
Right. Now, you know, last time we talked about Haiti. What is the update on Haiti there? Are we expecting some sort of, you know, better position right now? How should people, because the situation does not seem to be very good in Haiti, and the world is certainly concerned about it.
It's an absolute disaster. They have a leader named Barbecue that in itself is never a good sign. There's expecting a flood of refugees, naturally. There is an actual starvation crisis. There are pictures of people not getting enough food because of internal turmoil. There's been decades of mismanagement and various types of foreign intervention and peacekeeping and so forth have not been able to fix it, because essentially the country is dominated by corrupt gangs and there is no real leadership. And I think, unfortunately, there is no peaceful democratic way to resolve this problem at the moment. I think when you have a variety of warlords with weapons going at each other, this cannot end well unless some strong federal power is able to assume control. There has been voluntary attempts from El Salvador's leader, who very successfully dealt with the gang problem, to assist. But unless he becomes the single-handedly the leader of Haiti, I just don't see how that's going to work, you know, because you still need a leader. You still need someone who will take that control, take that responsibility, and give orders. Right now, there's no one to even who can even give those orders to deal with these people.
Right, right. Now let's our last story for the day is about Saudi Arabia, and it's a very important one. Irina, it has announced a $40 billion investment into artificial intelligence, and it wants to upend the semiconductor industry and bring it to the Middle East. Saudi Arabia into artificial intelligence, bringing this industry. Help us understand what is happening out there.
So actually, the interest in AI has been sprouting all over the Middle East, countries like Egypt that have been facing significant economic obstacles are using AI for elements of the economy where it makes sense. Not for everything, but for things that automate and cheapen processes. In countries like UAE, are creating entire, government offices to deal with the AI issue. And there's a lot of labs looking to attract diverse international and domestic talent. Saudi Arabia's investment, however, would be by far the largest. It would, everything else would dwarf in comparison. It would be very, very significant. But there are also obstacles on successful implementation. If it wants to do anything more than just invest in other international startups and create its own atmosphere, it really needs to cultivate a lot of domestic talent. And that's where we have a serious issue. They just don't have enough people with enough skills. And while the government is looking to facilitate the entry into this sort of market and fund all these accelerators, there's a cultural problem, because the culture in the region as a whole and in Saudi Arabia as well is kind of, it's anti-initiative. So even when the government funds the initiatives, there's just this fear of failure. This, which is inherent to experimentation, to startups, to new ventures. And I think that this kind of thinking really will need to take time to overcome. So I think the progress on actually building up a domestic culture, not just inviting foreigners in, that's going to take more time than anything else, more time than money. It's really more an issue of getting used to innovation type of thinking, entrepreneurial culture, and kind of moving away from rigid hierarchical approach to things. So ironically, even when the government is trying to facilitate things moving faster, they can do so by removing regulations, by giving faster access to funding, by encouraging things to go, giving scholarships and so forth. But at the end of the day, if it comes from the top, it's ironically something that in itself is an obstacle.
Right, right. And so from my part of the world, a lot of people used to look at Saudi Arabia as a bit of a much more conservative, much more oil dependent, and in terms of their own way of doing business, though they have investments in many, many industries. But getting into this sort of an industry, that actually shows the mind of the leadership there And the getting into alignment with the mainstream development that is happening in the world, semiconductor is the big thing as of today. NVIDIA, other companies, and a lot of world requires this semiconductor power into artificial intelligence and all things electronic. So help us understand, where is Saudi Arabia going? Is it trying to become a much more modern, understanding sort of a power? Much more, is it about business or is it about the whole mindset that they are trying to change there about themselves, also about the world?
I think necessarily when you are opening yourself for business, you will force, an open mindset, at least when you're actually trying to liberalize your own economy. It doesn't work, if you just send people out, to gain new skills, they will not automatically liberalize the mindset just by staying somewhere for a few years and coming back. Because at the end of the day, they come back to the same culture and they get stuck in this culture. But when they're changing the entire business model abroad, that does change the mindset of the entire population. That said, I would actually caution everyone from celebrating too early, because as we have seen with China, liberalizing economies at various points of time does not mean a significant political or cultural shift necessarily. It just means more people making money faster. And that does not necessarily change their views on anything else. Saudi Arabia at various points in time has tried to also change views on other things. But we should just caution ourselves from mistaking technological innovation from liberalizing mindsets, because we have seen even very conservative or authoritarian regimes and cultures successfully integrate technology when needed. I'm not saying that will necessarily be the case with Saudi Arabia. We should just be careful about not confusing technological innovation for modernization in other areas of life. That said, I do think there's been a significant shift in other cultural aspects. I think it's very promising that women and young people are becoming increasingly, the doors are being opened to them. And I think that is not something that is deniable. I do think it still will take time for more of the country, whether in Saudi Arabia or elsewhere in the Middle East, for these things to trickle down culturally and affect more than urban, more liberal, more professional areas. But I think that is a significant step in the right direction. And I think these sort of projects will open even more doors and more opportunities.
Absolutely, absolutely. And talking of technology, the negative aspect of technology is healthcare under attack from hackers in the US. How do you see that? What is happening? Because healthcare is such a crucial thing, and it's very worrisome that healthcare facilities are also not out of bounds from hackers.
So there's a couple of factors. First of all, healthcare has a lot of valuable data. And not just data. Data can be sold, of course. So there's this financial incentive. But data can be used also to profile people, and in more serious cases, there's additional motivation of creating chaos, sowing distrust in the institutions, or even simply, you could even launch deadly attacks when technology is integrated, medical devices are integrated with these sort of devices that can be accessed from externally. So you have the combination of these opportunities that may interest different actors, ranging from regular cyber criminals looking to make a buck by whatever means, to activists, to intelligence agencies and terrorists and so forth. But on the other hand, you also have the vulnerabilities. The sector is not well regulated in terms of cyber security and reporting requirements. A lot of the technologies and cybersecurity approaches are outdated, and they're simply not well enough. The personnel is not well trained, and it's also very interdependent. So unless every aspect of the entire chain of healthcare industry is secure, then you know, it can all fall apart, as we have seen with the United Healthcare hack, when a medical billing group ended up attacked, and that turned into a huge, disaster for the entire industry. So they all got tied up. They had to pay huge ransomware fines, initially in the millions and later on in the billions. So we have seen why this is both a lucrative area and a low-hanging fruit for the hackers.
Absolutely. The lot of world is changing very fast. A lot of things are happening in the world at the same time. And to make sense of it all, we will continue to get you on The World According to Irina Zuckerman every 2 weeks. With this, it's a wrap on this very special edition of the KAJ Masterclass Live. Thank you so much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.